Good evening, and welcome to the 15th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Tonight, I have the special pleasure of interviewing Dr. Colin Campbell, PhD, emeritus professor at the University of Cornell. Dr. Campbell is the author of the world-renowned China study, as well as Whole and the Low-Carb Fraud. There are so many books on the shelves and in web browsers that are filled with how-to advice for diet, nutrition, with little reference to scientific data. Dr. Campbell actually did the research and reported it firsthand. Then he and his family actually adopted the plant-based lifestyle and lived by the findings. He continued to publish his works despite threats to lose his funding and to lose other grants, even though he worked at a major university. It's amazing that the China study was published first in 2006 and was a sleeper until recently. And all the books that have been published on high-protein, low-carb diets have achieved great success despite the data that he published in 2006 of how harmful protein is, excessive animal protein especially, is in the diet. And basically greater than 10% protein in the diet has shown a marked increased risk in the development of both coronary artery disease and cancer. He documented that in countries where they ate predominantly rice and vegetables or sweet potatoes and vegetables, they're in a high-fiber diet, there was essentially no cancer, no breast cancer, no prostate cancer, no colon cancer, and very little coronary artery disease. Yet all this has gone virtually unpublicized in the media as well as in university literature, largely because of fear from the repercussions of the meat and dairy industry. So tonight you have the opportunity to be informed firsthand by the horse's mouth, Dr. T. Colin Campbell, on the benefits of a plant-based diet. So enjoy, listen, and learn. Hi, Dr. Campbell.
Yes.
This is Jamie Delaney. How are you?
Very good, thank you. I guess you got my email. I just saw your reply.
I did. Fantastic. I love it. Welcome to the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Podcast. It is such an honor to get to speak with you. You changed my whole practice.
Well, thank you very much. Good luck. Glad to hear that.
Yeah, I've taken your eCornell course. I've been diving into everything you print, and it's just amazing. We can start at the beginning and give the readers a little, or the listeners, I should say, a little glimpse into what got you started, which is fantastic. Go ahead and get started as far as how things got started and where we are now.
Well, first off, I don't know of any others who are not necessarily from the farm like I was. I'm not sure of that, but in any case, some have had some association, I guess. That's where I started, obviously, and then when I was in graduate school at Cornell University, I did a doctoral dissertation, with the presumption that animal protein or total protein was extremely important, obviously, and the more the better, and that's what I was all about. And then I went to the Philippines, got involved in a project there, coordinating a nationwide program of feeding malnourished children, and just started discovering something very different, that when protein is fed in excess of, what we really need, we might expect some problems. And then what I focused on was the relationship between overconsumption of protein and the development of primary liver cancer that I thought I was seeing in the children. I thought I saw that link. It was nothing published, but it was just an impression. But then there was another study that came out. Animals from India sort of supported the idea, and that all of that just led to my getting a grant from NIH that continued for the next 27 years, and some other grants too, but that one in particular Which I really wanted to know, is it really true that, you know, overconsumption of protein, especially animal-based protein, might stimulate the formation of cancer? And we studied that up one side and down the other, all the way from, you know, subcellular events and a lot of enzyme activities and so forth and so on. We looked at it really at a very fundamental level, and I became convinced that it really was true, at least on with the model we were using, and learned a lot about how it worked, and eventually started asking questions, well, if that's true, you know, are there other sort of parallel things that might be going on also with that same nutrient, and maybe other nutrients as well that might come along with extra protein? And the more I got into it, and over the years, the more I became aware that this is really kind of a big story. And eventually, I mean, it's complex biology, as you so well know. And so it's not an easy story to tell to, let's say, the public maybe. But the answer is fairly simple. And that is a whole food plant-based diet seems to have this really incredible property of making us well. Maybe reversing diseases, certainly stopping disease progression, certainly preventing a variety of diseases. And so it did. Indeed, it became a big story. And finally, I wrote the popular book, The China Study, with my son, my younger son, who now himself is a physician, by the way. He was an actor at the time, good writer, and he really helped me a lot in that book. So we've came out with that book. It's done exceedingly well, much better than I thought it was going to be. Then I wrote another book called Whole that came out in 2013. You know, attempted to talk a little bit more about why we haven't heard this before. And so, in the meanwhile, I've been giving lectures all over the place and having a lot of fun talking to people, giving a lot of lectures to medical schools in particular. And the exciting part of it, I guess, is not only do we see results that are really meaningful for people, but also sometimes this is not the most pleasant thing in the world too, but I run into a lot of controversy. I don't mind challenges, and so it's sharpens my, it sharpens my wit a little bit if I could take on some of the people who disbelieve it. But it is, it's a big story. And I'm, of course, delighted to hear from you.
Yeah.
Yourself being a professional and, you know, trying it out on your patients and stuff like that, that's really grand.
Well, you know, I started in this, I read Diet for a New America with John Robbins, and it became a personal story. But I have to say that Forks Over Knives, you know, with you and Dr. Esselstyn really convinced me that I had to take it further and, you know, introduce it and educate my patients. And then that's when I did the eCornell course. I'm just completely on board, and I can't believe that not more is out there. And I, you know, some of the things that I find, you know, extremely interesting, of course, is, you know, the casein protein and juvenile diabetes. And of course, you know, and then the childhood cancer and then the breast cancer and the colon cancer. Actually today, a patient came in and her husband had high cholesterol, and, you know, I was talking to them about, you know, plant-based diet. And she said, well, I actually had breast cancer. And her physician actually told her that he was Asian. And he said, you know, in Japan, Asians that don't eat a standard American diet or eat, you know, hasn't infiltrated, have a very, you know, the older Japanese women had very low incidence of breast cancer. And please don't, you know, do any dairy and don't do any animal products. Of course, she did not heed those words. But I thought, well, at least, geez, there's somebody else out there. So that was pretty cool.
Well, that's interesting. Sort of like that story that I just learned about from that guy in Ireland.
Yeah, Dr. Kelly. Yeah, I think that's very, very interesting. What do you think about, I mean, I'm convinced that, you know, obviously with your work, that if we decrease the, you know, if we get rid of animal products and dairy, that the incidence of these cancers will drop dramatically. What about the woman that, you know, and there's a book called Dr. Ruth Heydrich, she's a PhD, you know, she actually treated with McDougall treated her breast cancer. But how do you feel about you know, treating cancer, breast cancer, we'll say in particular, you know, going whole plant-based foods, you know, not the processed stuff, but, you know, what's your feelings on that as far as keeping it at bay?
Well, you know, of course, I'm talking, as you, I'm sure, recognize, you know, from just gathering evidence from here and there, nothing, no promises, but I think that the weight of the evidence favoring the use of a plant-based diet to control breast cancer and even reverse it, I think the weight of the evidence is very strong. I only wish that, you know, people, including both the professionals, you know, the primary care doctors as well as the patients, you know, had enough courage to try it. I mean, that's an easy thing to say. I've actually been talking around quite a bit for, gosh, 20 years now or more, especially to medical schools and talking to my colleagues in medicine. You know, but this question, why is it we can't seem to, find some way to formally test this idea? Maybe get a bunch of breast cancer cases to do it. Now I know that's not really not easy, because most people, once diagnosed, are quite vulnerable, and they want to go with what they believe to be, you know, the traditional way of doing things, certainly wanting to listen to their oncologist. I understand all that. But on the other hand, I also understand, I learned this from a fairly eminent cancer researcher recently at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center, who offered to maybe get some patients together and do that kind of thing, because he says there's an increasing number of patients now, once diagnosed with various and sundry kinds of cancer, they don't want to go the traditional route. They don't want the chemo. They don't want the radiation. They don't want even surgery sometimes, if that's called for. And so, you know, they're kind of open, you know, to some new ideas. And so I've just been learning from some of my fellow colleagues in medicine, I guess you could say, that maybe people are warming up to trying this. I think, you know, to compare any kind of research that we do, whether it's in, you know, the research laboratory or in the clinic, it seems to me every time we sit down and we try to figure out, okay, we want to try this, that, or something else, we're of course, first having to basically look at the preliminary evidence to support the hypothesis in the beginning. And I would argue that the evidence that we now have supporting that hypothesis is far more substantial than, let's say, the evidence that might be used as a basis for testing yet another chemotherapy drug. And so it's a conundrum, but sorry for such a long answer, but it has been kind of a difficult question to ask, let alone test. On the other hand, I think the evidence we now have is really substantial. And that's why I thought this guy in Ireland who comes along, I don't know him, I never heard of him, that popped up in the news two days ago. And I said, wow, he doesn't have enough cases to, you know, to really be terribly certain about anything, but just the way that was written, I haven't contacted him, I'm going to, but the way it was written and according to the reporter, this gentleman seems to be really impressed with what he's seeing, so.
Well, didn't, you know, with Ruth Heydrich, are you familiar with her story and Dr.
Yeah, I know her quite well. In fact, I was just out in Hawaii about 3 weeks ago giving a lecture to her and her group. Yeah, I know her well.
So actually, Dr. McDougall attempted to do something like that at one point, correct?
Yeah, he did. He did it for more of a general purpose kind of thing, just for helping people with various syndrome kind of ailments. Diabetes and heart disease, I think, was the neat thing. Ruth did get her first information from John McDougall, because he started his practice in Hawaii, or at least he did his residency in Hawaii before he came to California many years ago. And she learned from him that it might be a good idea, and she sort of went that route. And did really well by it. she started running marathons, and now she's 74 or 5, I think. Still running marathons.
Right, right. But I interviewed her, and she told me that he actually had placed an ad in the paper looking for people that wanted to try to treat their breast cancer with diet.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah,
wow, I didn't,
that's what she told me. Yeah,
well,
and I you know, so I wondered, you know, of course, maybe didn't, you know, she's a study of one, perhaps. But, yeah, I mean, I think it would be I do think there's more and more people that would probably, if they were informed, I think the problem is education.
And I
think that, you know, again, you're right. People are vulnerable and they're afraid to go against the grain. And she had mentioned, too, that, you know, her family basically, you know, said you're crazy if you don't do conventional therapy. And,
right.
You know, I think there's so much pressure, and then the legal aspect of it, you know, is like, what kind of quack are you recommending plants as opposed to chemotherapy and radiation? And, you know, but I do think more and more people, and I think there's more and more information that chemotherapy is really not the answer in this.
Right.
So
it really doesn't make any sense from my way of thinking. These are very toxic drugs. And the cytotoxic agents themselves, you know, they're basically carcinogenic.
Yes.
And that goes along with some observations showing that, you know, secondary cancers can occur in people who are using these agents. You know, and they're used out of context. They're a foreign compound. They don't make any sense. I think it's crazy. It was a crazy idea in the beginning.
Now, so I have to go back, and I talked to Ann Esselstyn, you know, when Dr. Esselstyn decided to, and I think it's a little bit ironic that he was a breast cancer surgeon, and then he chose to kind of focus on cardiac patients, and, you know, you're the guy finding the breast cancer. But, you know, I asked her, I said, well, what happened the day that Doc came home and said, okay, we're all plant-based? So what happened in your household, you know, when you started seeing this overwhelming evidence is like, whoa, this milk protein is nasty, and, you know, people do better on a plant-based diet, and you tell your wife, who's also written a very good cookbook that I have.
That's our daughter.
Oh, daughter, I'm sorry. And, you know, but that, you know, it's like, well, you know, so when did the whole Campbell family go plant-based?
Well, this is back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. At that time, we had 4 or 5 children. The fifth, the youngest, had just been born, I guess. And I had a large research program and working on this whole idea, you know, of this observation that it seemed to be interesting, that casein could turn on cancer. And by the late 70s, by that time, I already had proven to myself that this observation was real. We could turn on and turn off cancer to some extent, you know, with the protein in question. And we were working pretty hard to try to understand what the biochemical mechanism for this effect really was. So with that background, I said, you know, there's something here. Of course, I told my wife about it, obviously, and one thing led to another. We started eating more salads. But that at that time meant more turkey salad and tuna fish salad, I guess. And so we gradually worked into it. I mean, I knew that from my own personal background and professional associations that to talk about casein causing cancer, I mean, that's like pouring gasoline on a hot fire, you know, in the scientific community, let me tell you. And, you know, and so I had to ask myself. I mean, I really wanted to be convinced, you know, and it took a few years to do that almost, you know. And so we went into it fairly gradually. In the beginning, it was eating more salads and finally real salads, not with the chicken or the fish in it, but and then dropping the red meat in the middle 80s, and then getting on to the late 80s, quitting the dairy for sure, and going the whole way about 1990 or so. And so, and to answer your question, we did it gradually. I would have been, I guess, reluctant, just like everybody else, had I not actually been doing the research. Because doing the research, I mean, we were designing the studies, asking the questions, and just testing the idea from different angles. So I became a firm believer, let me tell you. It really worked that way. And I was also had been quite involved, actually, in these so-called expert committees that were helping to set national policy and international policy, as a matter of fact, too. You know, food and health policy, essentially. And I'd be on these committees with colleagues from, you know, various disciplines, the medical discipline, other areas of research and stuff. And, of course, I was coming to terms with our results. And I was on there in part because there were some people who thought, wow, this is pretty interesting. And, you know, I was publishing all of it, of course. But being on these committees and getting really good critique, you know, from my colleagues who sort of were in the field in a sense, it gave me, I guess, a lot of confidence because I could begin to answer their questions, however skeptical they may have been. And that was kind of fun. And so, so early 90s, I guess that's when we, you know, said, okay, this is it. My wife was fantastic. She, we both had our personal experience, like everyone else does. And she had her mother, when her mother was 51 and she was the only daughter, her mother passed because of colon cancer. And at that time, she was really had no money to even earn to have insurance, health insurance. And so they didn't treat her right away because she didn't have health coverage. So that was a pretty tragic event, jarring to say the least. And my wife really became interested in getting more serious about this whole question, pushing me on it. And my dad, too, a farmer, he you know, was always outdoors. You would have thought he would have been fine, but he and his brother, and that's my uncle, and his father, my grandfather, they all got heart disease fairly early, you know, eating high-fat diets and stuff like that, a lot of animal foods. And he passed when he was 70. He got his attack. First attack was 62. So we had our family situation that I know a lot of people do. But in my case, it was not only personal, but it was professional, too, because, you know, here we're looking at this stuff, you know, thinking about it and so forth, and said, you know, let's get serious about this. And my wife then was really getting on with figuring out how to cook food and make it really tasty. She'd done a wonderful job doing that. And so it was a combined effort, obviously, including myself and my wife and all the students and colleagues I had over the years, too. They were working on bits and pieces of the question. And it's all come out. Right now, it's very exciting. It's very exciting. I think the idea is really pretty profound that food can have this kind of effect, you know, on overall health. And it reminds me of the old statement Hippocrates made, you know, more than 2,000 years ago, that says, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food.
I was just going to bring that up. I mean, are you familiar with the movie, the documentary Cowspiracy?
I do.
I see the similarities in the medical profession as far as, you know, the politics associated with Big Pharma and, you know, the constraints that are put on this evaluation. I know you've had some issues as well, trying to get things, you know, more, you know, it's hard to sell carrots, you know, it's hard to, there's not much sponsorship in the broccoli industry.
Right. I should tell you, you've seen Force of an Eyes, by the way. My oldest son actually now has just finished with his crew a new film as the next, sort of the next Force of an Eyes kind of thing, taking a step further. And he actually, the producer of Force of an Eyes, John Corey, you know, an established, experienced producer actually in the movie industry. John Corey's working with him, the screenwriter in Force of an Eyes working with him. And he's got, you know, some other people. They have just finished a fantastic film, I must tell you. It'll be out in theater on July 4th. That's the scheduled date. And we're going to be going around the country for the months of April and May, doing some screenings in probably somewhere around 25 or 30 cities, wherever people may be interested in putting together a crowd. And what Force of an Eyes, if I may just briefly speak to that, Force of an Eyes, in a sense, was a film that was done by group in sort of in the movie industry. It came to me, and it came to Dr. Esser and some others. So what we were attempted to do in that film was simply to kind of lay out the information, say, here it is, folks, you know, what do you think about this kind of thing? I mean, it was, it's really, that film's done really well. So it's sort of unbelievable. But we didn't really get a chance in the film very much to talk about why we haven't heard this before. And that's always been a pet interest of mine, because I was in policy a lot. And I think I know some answers about why we haven't heard this before. A lot of first-hand experiences. And so the second film actually started when I was invited to speak on the floor of the Kentucky legislature. Got my friend Dr. Esselstyn to come along, and the two of us, we spoke on that. We were the first ones in 130 years outside of the chamber, you know, who were invited to speak, and we got a standing ovation. Hello?
Hi, we got cut off at the legislature and the opportunity to speak.
Okay, I'll carry on. So in any case, after we finished our talk, then one of the senior members of the legislature, a 30-year member, who was really enthusiastic about this, he got my oldest son and I to talk about the possibility of coming to Kentucky to help them reorganize the whole healthcare system for that state.
Wow.
And 89 of the 100 members of the legislature sponsored a resolution, a non-binding resolution, that this be done. And then they passed it unanimously after that. And then it went to budgetary hearings about a few weeks later, you know, to put some money into it to get the thing rolling. And it was kind of heady stuff for us. I mean, I was kind of excited about it, actually. And so went to committee, and they then the most intense lobbying effort they've ever seen occurred. They blocked it, they stripped it, and they just really took the legislature apart, in a sense. And so they killed a bill in many ways. All that was on camera, by the way.
Wow.
At least on the floor, all that the argument on the floor was on camera. Mark talks were on camera. So then my son went back in North Carolina, where he lives, and his background is in economics and government. He has a lot of interest in the political arena. So he organized a story for a small town in North Carolina involving, you know, leaders in the community and so forth and so on. So much of the film then is focused on, you know, what happened there in North Carolina after that, you know, that failure in Kentucky, in a sense. But then, in the end, they went back to Kentucky and organized a new amendment. We called it Kentucky Surprise. And the legislators were basically asked to vote on an amendment that they didn't know was coming. They only learned about it the morning they came in. And I was told I should not be in the area. And there were cameras in the legislature, and again, all that was captured on camera. And so they were having to face, essentially, in effect, they had to face a proposition without my telling you the details, which I can't do, but they, in a sense, the legislators were facing a proposition to vote on whether or not they wanted to tell the truth. And I'll just stop there. But it's a very exciting film.
Oh, I can't wait
and,
now.
we've got a trailer for it. I can send it down to you.
Okay, great. That would be fantastic. Yeah, I mean, well, I you know, the first thing that comes to mind is Yum Industries and Kentucky Fried Chicken. You know, I mean, it's like,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah. You know, that I grew up in West Virginia, and my daughter's ex-phys major there. And when I went to orientation with her, I'm sitting in the audience, and the director or the chairman of the department is talking about how they're getting a grant to study the reasons for obesity in West Virginia. And I grew up there. It's like, you know, I wanted to raise my hand. It's like, I know the reason. You know, it is the food that these people eat, you know, and it's just amazing, but nobody wants to address, you know, it's just, and I do believe it's just very political. It's not, everybody's afraid to address it.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. But by the way, where in West Virginia where you raised?
Morgantown, the West Virginia University. And so, I mean, that particular area, you know, was, you know, more of a college town, but you didn't have to get 30 minutes out of the town where, you know, I mean, there was poverty and, you know, I had patients. I actually was on faculty there for 3 years after I finished my fellowship. And, you know, I had patients tell me, you know, doc, I'd rather die than give up gravy. And they were having their heart attacks in their, you know, 50s and 60s. It was horrible, and it's not changed a whole lot there. And the worst thing is I'm in Florida now, and I'm seeing, instead of the age, you know, when I first came to Florida, you know, people in their 80s were having their heart attacks, and it was very few in their 60s. And now that, you know, it's backing up to catch up with West Virginia. I'm seeing more people in their 50s and 60s with diffuse coronary artery disease and obesity and diabetes.
You put your finger right on the key question, and that is... not only why people haven't heard it before, but why is it so difficult for people to really understand this? I mean, this information has been so suppressed, so completely suppressed in a way, you know, intentionally or unintentionally, it's beside the point in some ways, but it, people just haven't learned about this, never haven't heard about it. And
I'm starting to
question a little bit more.
I'm starting to lose you a little bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, can you hear me okay now?
Yes, better. Yes, much better.
Okay. I was walking around this room here a little bit. I should stay in one place. Okay. So, I'm glad you're really onto this. I think we've got a challenge in front of us, but I also see a lot of evidence now beginning to emerge that is very encouraging. Believe it or not, I've probably given about 600 lectures, I think.
Wow.
Since the China study came out in 2005. And actually all over the world and all kinds of audiences, including twice pharmaceutical company executives and you know, people like that, livestock producers, in addition to the general public and obviously the medical practitioner community itself. It's been a lot of fun. And it's a hard thing to sell for a lot of people, as you know. But it's sort of a question of, I think, it's my experience at least, of trying to figure out, you know, how can you tell this story with real evidence so that the public can understand it as well as the professionals.
I think, you know, your book, your latest book on the low carb fraud, I think, you know, that's the confusion out there with the number of the books, you know, or the Nutrisystem and you know, eat what you want, eat pizza, eat candy, lose weight, and the low carb, eat cheese, eat bacon, the paleo, eat bacon. You know, I think it's so confusing, and they there's somebody with an MD by their name or something, and everybody jumps on, and they're telling people what they want to hear, and they grasp onto that.
Absolutely. That is so true. I just got an invitation to be on a panel, actually, this coming month in Appalachian State. I just mentioned this one because it's kind of interesting. They have this series of it's a course, apparently, on the campus. They during the course they show various films and then the students critique it and so forth, and they open it up to the campus community in a sense. And so they're going to show this new film, relatively new film, called Fed Up.
Mm-hmm.
Whether
you've
seen that or not.
I have.
I don't like that film, to be honest about it. I know most of those people personally, and their intent has been to try to just do anything they can to disrupt this message that I'm talking about. And they're doing very subtly and very effectively at times. And anyhow, they did a film with a lot of money behind it. It went out. And so they're going to show that film on the campus. And so the organizer of the film, she hadn't got my book. She didn't even know I had written a book for that matter. She saw I had written an article on a website called Fed Up with Fed Up. And she was calling around to get some people to be on the panel, and everyone that she called, the only thing they could speak to was their belief in the paleo diet. They really believed in the paleo diet. She couldn't find anybody who had an alternative view. So she asked me if I'd come down and offer the opposing view. But you're right. You know, there's the whole idea of the paleo diet really has, you know, spread far and wide. And before that, it was the Atkins diet and the South Beach diet and the Zone diet and you name it. I mean, they're all basically low-carb diets. And they're trying to protect the status quo. That's what they're doing.
Well, and then, you know, there's this other movement that sugar is horrible. And, of course, everybody's confused about it. You know, Atkins, unfortunately, you know, made carbs a devil. And so the sugar is bad and the ketotic diet and being in ketosis all the time. I mean, can you address, do you know anything about the research with ketosis and cancer and, you know, that aspect of things?
I do to some extent. You know, some of that idea got started, not necessarily on the ketotic idea, but it was started by a guy in Germany by the name of Otto Warburg, W-A-R-B-U-R-G. He had gotten a Nobel Prize. In fact, I think he had two. Otto Warburg was a big voice, big name back in the 30s, 20s and 30s, and on into the 40s. He also was still around in the 50s a little bit when I was just going to graduate school. And everybody who Warburg was at the time, and what he was discovering, which was part of the reason he got the Nobel Prize, was the fact that cancer cells tend to live quite well in an anaerobic environment. And so in an anaerobic environment, it's less efficient, you know, for glucose, for example, to be metabolized to get the energy out of it. It's only partially metabolized, you see. And so as a result, there has to be, you know, it consumes, the cancer cell in a sense, the neoplastic state, consumes a lot of sugar. And this led to the idea over the years that, you know, sugar feeds cancer. And that's just a simple part of the story. In a sense it does, but in a sense it doesn't. But anyhow, this connection between sugar and cancer has been around quite a long time. And then it came around to the low-carb movement, which obviously means no sugar. And the idea there, part of the argument is, as you're already inferring, is that, you know, if you have too much of a carbohydrate, you're going to feed cancer. So therefore, the opposite of that is to go to ketosis, get a high-protein, high-fat diet type of diet. And that ought to have some benefits. That's about as far as I can go on this. I don't know of any really any evidence, convincing evidence that I know of that you know, ketotic products or ketones, if you will, really have any effect on the cancer cell. Do you know of any?
I don't. Other than, you know, people say, well, you know, cancer cells, you know, metabolize sugar and they seem to, you know, thrive on sugar. But I don't know of any real research and any whole research that, you know, other than, you know, starving a cancer, so to speak, you know. But I don't know of anything formal. And then the same thing goes, you know, people say, you know, they turn it around and they say, what about gluten? And, you know, from my perspective, I typically get people that are, you know, significantly overweight and they have cardiovascular disease. And a lot of them have cancer, too. And I'm trying to get them to, you know, go plant-based. And one of the side effects that I see early on is either they throw olive oil on everything and or they are eating a bunch of pasta and breads as an alternative. And, of course, then we don't get anywhere. And it takes a long time to tease that out. In this plant-based movement, it's kind of funny. You look, there's the people that, you know, you can eat a few nuts, don't eat any nuts. Some oils, yes. You know, some flour, unprocessed, you know, rice or, you know, unprocessed grains are okay. What has been your feeling or your stance on all that?
Well, it comes back to sort of the question in the sense of, you know, what does the science really support? I mean, how far can it go, or how far we can go in saying, you know, a whole food plant-based diet does all the wonderful things it does. The way I like to say it in this way, to honor the science, as well as to try to answer the question for people too, is I like to say that the goal is a whole food plant-based diet. The closer one gets into that, the better off they're going to be. And so I then, in that same breath, I sort of say, I honor the step that everyone takes, you know, toward that goal. I find that it's a little more comfortable for me to say it that way, because it's less, if you will, almost, to say it the other way around, you know, black and white kind of thing, it's almost a little bit dictatorial, I think. And sometimes you can turn off people. But then I go ahead and make the case, if I can, that, you know, going 100%, you might as well go the whole way if you're going to do this. And I say there's two reasons to go the whole way. One is the benefits you get. I mean, it continually improve. And sometimes just a little bit of the wrong kind of food is going to really bother people, especially people who have already been diagnosed with something. So, but at the same time, I know that there are people who can do quite well by, let's say, going 80, 90% of the way, 95% of the way. You know, some people, and I think they're the minority. But we never know who we are, really, you know, what our risk really is, necessarily. And so going 100% of the way, you know, you can get all the benefits that are supposedly there, especially if one has a disease of some kind, the need to go the whole way. And the other point of it, too, is that going 100%, I'm sure you've probably experienced this, our taste preferences begin to change. And we get away from the addiction that we're accustomed to with oil, especially, and sugar, too. And so by staying with the, you know, total program, we have some halfway decent research that shows that after 2, 3, or 4 months or so, it may take that long, people then begin to really like this food. A lot of people, you know, like it much before that. And they become accustomed to the taste. And first thing you know, I'd like to say that people actually crave a salad. Yes. I kind of guess their attention when I say that. And that way, saying it that way, then I don't have to try to defend that everybody has to be 100%. You know, some people get by with it, but, you know, even the people who do pretty well by only go on 89% of the way, I say if they go 100%, then they can get used to it, and then they don't get confused. It's like the cigarette thing. Tell people, you know, smokers, you can have a cigarette or two, you know, every night, maybe. They don't quit when they do that.
Right, and yeah.
So I just say, go the whole way. And on the nuts and things along those lines, my friend Dr. Esselstyn, he's pretty stern. He has been, because he's got heart patients, and he produced some marvelous, you know, results. So I think he's got fantastic, you know, evidence. And I hadn't quite gone in that school until maybe, I don't know, a few months ago. Maybe just a little bit of fat occasionally. My wife has always been opposed to me doing, you know, even using any at all, but now I'm totally in that camp. For me, it's, you know, no added oil, no fat. And I'm making that decision in part on some evidence that I've seen from some people who almost got there, but they kept on using oil and they still had problems. And then when they quit the oil, they got better. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as far as the more formal science is concerned, we could use a little more work in that area to see, you know, if there are people. I don't know whether we really want to do that, but it might be, you know, sort of informative. But we might learn, you know, about maybe some individuals, a few individuals who can survive on having a little oil. I mean, I'm talking in an abstract way right now, but as I say, I don't know why we want to do that. I just need to go the whole way.
Yeah, I agree. It's, you know, and the research, you know, I mean, I can see where the research is so hard. Again, going back to my problems in my office dealing with patients and getting them, the perception of what people eat is so difficult. And I think mm-hmm. that's why a lot of people argue about some of these studies, because if you, you know, if I ask somebody, you know, what did you have for dinner last night? You know, it takes me the next 20, 30 minutes to tease it out to get everything. And, you know, I think people, and you know, the detailed diaries, You know, it would take a lot of work to really tease it out, and you're going to do this, and you're not, you know what I mean? I just don't think that right. people are aware of they, you know, walk by something and grab a handful of this, and certainly, you know, the, I don't know if it's the nut people or the planters people or whoever it is, but, you know, nuts have become a health food, you know, the ones that are roasted in oil, and, you know, the big, you know, we have a Sam's down here that, you know, they sell the big half-gallon barrels of the things that they're sitting by their chair while they're watching TV, and, you know, it's like, well, that's not what I'm talking about.
Right.
Right. What about, you know, your book called Whole, which is also very, very good, and, you know, brings a lot of this together. You know, I have patients come in and they don't want to take other medicines, but boy, they have a bag full of vitamins. And to get them off of, you know, even their, you know, their multivitamin and their all these different vitamins is really difficult. And he's like, "What? You know, they're not good for me." And
well, I have followed the emergence of that industry from its beginning, essentially. I mean, it does go back to the 30s and 40s and 50s a little bit, but it really took off during the 70s and in the early 80s, middle 80s actually. He's got some boosts from the politicians, essentially. A couple of bills were passed to allow them to make claims and so forth and so on. That got started on the basis of the National Academy of Science report at that time in 1982 called Diet, Nutrition, and Cancer. It was the first of its kind. And I was one of the members of that 13-member committee, and I was kind of out there, you know, testimony before congressional committees and so forth and so on. I was sort of in the forefront of that, I guess. Then the industry got started and was claiming at that time that our report was justifying the development of vitamin supplements for preventing cancer. They took out full-page ads in Time Magazine and Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report, making these wild claims. And the Academy got annoyed with them and said, because we had said in our report this did not apply to vitamins, the industry said, you know, bugger you, we're going to do it anyhow, kind of thing. And so the Academy then went to the Federal Trade Commission to get the Federal Trade Commission to stop the industry from making these wild claims. And they asked me to be their key witness, you know, on the stand, interpreting the evidence as they were presenting it. And so that was my job for 3 years. And it was very educational. I could see what was on the inside of the committee. The industry was, on the other hand, trying to get me to get involved with them. They gave me a national award. They had me come to their, oh, my God, it was ridiculous. And so I saw firsthand, you know, what goes on behind the scenes as they were sort of really getting that industry going. And I saw, on the other hand, you know, claims they were making, which really were not justified. So I've watched that industry grow over the years very closely. And now we have evidence, really good evidence, you know, meta-analyses and really big studies that clearly show that of all the studies that have been done during the last two or three decades, we've finally arrived at a point right now where the evidence for me is really convincing. They don't work. They don't work. And in fact, there's too many instances now that are rising where those supplements actually have the opposite effect. And yet the industry keeps on pushing ahead. And in the short run, and I'm sure you've heard this, except for B12, by the way, in the short run, when one gives a nutrient supplement and then sees the level go up in the tissues or in the blood in particular, they in the past they counted that as a positive response when it's not. You know, that was not a functional result. That was just, you know, concentration-wise, it sort of got, it was increased. And so in the short run, sometimes you can actually see what look like to be beneficial effects, especially with antioxidants. You know, they cut down on excessive oxidation or for the damage resulting from free radical production, for example. You can see this kind of thing in the short run. Occasionally it looks impressive, so they move ahead and make claims about it and all that. But in the context of the whole body over time, it just doesn't work that way. The way I kind of look at that is the body is a little bit too smart for the rest of us. It knows how to handle things. And when it's got, you know, the whole food to work with, it picks and chooses which nutrients you know, it needs at any moment in time to do whatever it has to do. We just have to eat the right food, so we always have a ready supply of the things that the body needs for whatever it needs to do at that time. And to shove down our throats, you know, excessive doses of single nutrients out of context, just theoretically, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So now we have evidence to say that it really doesn't make sense. And what's interesting about this is that the industry just keeps going at it. They just keep on just, you know, they're less so maybe right now than what was 5-10 years ago. But they're still pushing their product. And they got half the people in the country on multiple vitamin supplements. I'm sure you've probably seen that in your patients, I guess.
Oh, it's yeah, it's amazing, and they're the you know the giant bottles, no less, you know, and it's incredible, you know, and the expense they're not cheap by any stretch of the imagination either, you know, and
absolutely.
But it, boy, I tell you, getting them off of it's almost as bad as getting them off cigarettes sometimes. Yes.
I think what you know probably the biggest damage that they do is they lead people to believe that they're actually doing something for their health. And that's all they need to do. And they can keep on just doing all the wrong things that they do. And, of course, that's a hoax. That really is a serious hoax. And so...
I think that the plant-based whole foods diet is so simple that it seems impossible to a lot of people. You know, and it's just amazing. And, I had the same this discussion with this lady today, and I had this discussion, and she was shaking her head yes and about the breast cancer and her husband's cholesterol, and she was shaking herself yes, and we were talking about industry, and we were talking about the dairy and the lobbyists and all this kind of stuff, and I thought I'd finally made some headway, and I stood up, and she said, "Do you have any samples of Crestor?"
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, no. And, you know, it's...
Wow.
So, you know, I mean, it just on and on and on. That's, you know, a lot of the reason I think this podcast, the more people hear, you know, I give them your reference. I give them Forks Over Knives. I think people have to, you know, see the videos, see the movies, read the books. And until you get people to do that for themselves and want to be educated, I don't think we're going to make any headway because, like you say, I think that the industry is so good at marketing these things. On the other hand, you know, the population, I'm frustrated that, you know, I see an older population and I think sometimes they think, well, the horse is out of the barn, so to speak. But, you know, I think it's a shame. Our school, you know, it's just everywhere. And I think the children are going to become much more sick because they're exposed to much more of this stuff. And, you know, at least back when, you know, I was younger and you were younger that, you know, there wasn't the pesticides and the antibiotics and all this other stuff that, you know, also contribute to things.
Right.
But, you know, now that they don't stand a chance.
Well, that's one of the things that I hope might come across as far as this new film is concerned. By the way, the name of the film is Plant Pure Nation.
Oh, perfect.
On July 4th, it should be out. But in any case... That film speaks to not just this question concerning why we haven't heard this before, in a sense, but it also speaks to, I think, a much larger question and a very sensitive one, and it has to do with the extent to which we citizens, you know, are being, in a sense, controlled by authoritative institutions, whether it's government or industry or whatever. And, you know, in this day and time, power, especially in conveying information to the public, is concentrated oftentimes in the hands of a relatively few number of people. And it's done in a very clever way, so the public doesn't really get to see, and the public, when they hear dietary guidelines, for example, comes out and makes the news, or they hear the media saying this, that, or something else, that, you know, where some journalist has been handed a news release by some company, you know, and very subtly prepared in a way, our whole society is unfortunately basically suffering from this control of information at the top, which raises questions about not only about food and health, but also about other things too. So I think then hopefully that will begin to raise some questions and let people hopefully get them to start questioning, you know, what the facts really are. And kind of hoping that discussion will, the discussion's already started right now. I mean, a lot of people are obviously disenchanted with our government or disenchanted with corporations or whatever. And this kind of, I think, you know, shed some light on how that works.
Fantastic. Well, you know, I certainly admire you for dedicating your career to this, you know, uphill battle. And, you know, I'm very excited about the movie that's coming out. You know, your work has been very inspirational. And just been a pleasure to get to speak with you. I'm losing you again.
Okay.
Are you back? Excuse me.
Yeah. Okay. Can you hear me?
Now I can. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Somehow I just landline in this house doesn't work too well. It seems to be sensitive to dead spots. Okay. Well, I appreciate your, as I said, the invitation, and wish you all the best. And don't hesitate to, you know, contact again if you know somebody in the area. We ought to be coming through Florida someplace showing that film. That's in March, April, and May.
Well, I'll keep in touch with you, and hopefully we can get a showing down here. We're just a little south of Sarasota, about an hour south of Tampa, so maybe okay. Somewhere in the vicinity. But I'd love to host you.
That'd be fantastic. Okay, we've got each other's emails, and we'll take it from there.
All right, I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good night, Dr. Campbell.
Dr. Campbell.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dr. Campbell. He was a delightful person to be to speak with. I'm honored to get so much information from him. I hope you look forward to his upcoming documentary. I'll keep you informed as to the timing of the release. I'm also interviewing his son in the next couple of months, who runs a plant-based primary care clinic and also is about to release a new book. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to contact me at jamiedulaney@gmail.com. It's jamiedulaney@gmail.com. I'll look forward to any questions that you might have. I'd like to answer anything you might have on the podcast, any questions. So feel free to contact me. Otherwise, continue to be plant strong in the new year.